A judge confirms bison are wildlife, not livestock. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about an upcoming job fair. And in our feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce talks with Governor Steve Bullock about what Montana is and should be doing about climate change. A Montana judge says bison from Yellowstone National Park still count as wild animals even after they were relocated and placed into fenced pastures. The ruling shoots down a claim from some eastern Montana officials and property rights advocates who argued that relocated bison fall under authority of the Department of Livestock. District Judge John McKeon wrote in yesterday's order that state law allows the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to capture, confine, or relocate bison. He says such activities do not change the animal's wild status. The plaintiff sued in 2012, hoping to stop the relocation of 68 bison to the central Montana's Fort Belknap and Fort Peck Indian reservations. State wildlife officials last week announced plans to relocate a group of roughly 135 Yellowstone bison before next winter.
And in other news from around the state, a 30-year-old Polson man has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole after being convicted of deliberate homicide in the May 2013 death of another man at Wild Horse Hot Springs, just outside the town of Hot Springs. KERRAM reports District Judge John Larson called Melvin Madplume Jr.'s crime, quote, horrendous and calculated, before sentencing him today for the death of 28-year-old Lawrence Kenmill of Elmo. Madplume was charged with raping and killing Kenmill in a hot tub. An autopsy determined Kenmill drowned due to homicidal violence. Madplume said today his heart was as broken as Kenmill's family over his death, but that a life sentence wasn't going to fix it.
As predicted by the National Weather Service, temperatures today range from the mid-60s to just above 70 degrees throughout much of our listening area. National Weather Service meteorologist Luke Robinson says that hasn't happened since September of last year. What's more, that's about 10 degrees warmer than normal for this time of year in Montana. So does that mean we could start to see some flooding today in areas with above-average snowpack?
Well, the warm-up's not going to last very long, so we're not really concerned about any flooding from any runoff, and we're not expecting any rain until Wednesday, and it looks fairly light. If there is any flooding in the Missoula Bitter Root Valley, it will likely be west of 93 at the base of the Bitter Root Range there. But we're not really concerned about it this week.
Temperatures will return to more seasonal norms later this week. Given the snowpack, however, the Weather Service says many of the major rivers will flood this spring, and we may face another active flood year like the one in 2011. Robinson cautions that a lot of that depends on how much precipitation we get in addition to the snowmelt. State and federal emergency management officials point out now is the time to purchase flood insurance. Under most circumstances, there's a 30-day waiting period from the time a policy is written and the premium is paid until the policy goes into effect. They say the process and rules can get complicated, so anyone thinking about flood insurance should contact an insurance agent for more information. Agents and additional information can be found at floodsmart.gov.
U.S. Senator John Walsh's campaign says it raised $946,000 over the first 3 months of the year in his bid to keep the seat he was appointed to in February. That's a nearly 62% increase over the Democratic candidate's fundraising for the last quarter of 2013, before Governor Steve Bullock appointed him to complete former Senator Max Baucus's term. Walsh campaign manager Aaron Murphy attributes the surge in contributions in part to a strong start to the abbreviated Senate term. The campaign said today it spent nearly $685,000 this quarter. Walsh has raised about $1.5 million since he entered the race and has nearly $700,000 on hand. Walsh is the first of the Senate candidates to release his fundraising figures for the quarter.
A sold-out job fair is a sign of the changing economic times in the Flathead. Katrin Fry reports this is the third year in a row for the spring fair after it took a three-year hiatus during the recession.
Between 2009 and 2011, there really weren't many jobs to speak of, so the Flathead Job Service did not hold its annual spring job fair. Manager of the job service, Bill Nelson, says in the depths of the recession, they were listing about 40 job openings. Over the last few days, it's closer to 500. The Flathead Valley Community College and Job Service have been holding the fair now for 3 years running. Student advisor and navigator Jory Bulmer with FVCC also used to work at the job service.
Last year, the event ended up being huge, which was a real boom, I think, to everyone's sort of sense of how the economy is doing. There were some years prior to that where there really weren't a lot of employers to offer a job fair. And so to see it really take off like it did last year was great, and we're already full this year.
Bulmer says they have 70 businesses signed up, and only a handful of them are Bakken oil field related companies.
There's seasonal work, there is full-time permanent work, there is everything from nonprofit to service industry to the energy sector to the local firearms industries. It's really all over the place. Healthcare. I really think there's a little something for everybody.
Nelson says the unadjusted unemployment rate for the Flathead for February sits at 8.3%. Compare that to February of 2010, when it hit a high of 13.3%. The fair is on April 16th at the Community College Arts and Technology Building from 12:30 to 4, opening at 12 to veterans and their families. Leading up to the fair are a number of classes, both at FVCC and the job service, on things like how to handle the interview and building or tuning up your resume. Bulmer says resumes have changed a lot in the last decade.
It really needs to be almost like a marketing document anymore. And if you can't catch the employer's eye right near the top of your resume and pique their interest, they're never going to see what's on the bottom.
Bulmer says it's also important to tailor each resume you send to the specific job you're applying for. She says job seekers should be prepared to interview right then and there at the job fair. Prep courses are available at FVCC up to the event and year-round through the Flathead Job Service. Katherine Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report at the end of March. The panel, established by the United Nations, continues to point to the vast majority of scientific research indicating human activity is a primary driver of our warming global climate. In Montana, research suggests a future with lower mountain snowpack, hotter, drier summers, and more severe wildfires. In this evening's feature interview, Governor Steve Bullock speaks with Capitol reporter Dan Boyce about what he thinks the state should be doing to address the issue. Bullock believes very few people these days would deny the climate is changing. That is, he says, few people who are not members of Congress.
Especially in Montana, we're outdoors folks. We see it from our precipitation's different. Last year, I went from floods to fire season in declaring emergencies in matters of weeks, and we see it changing, and it can have a significant impact also in what we as Montanans enjoy, as streams are getting closed earlier in the season as a result of water temperatures and the loss of water. What I've said to many, though, is that even if they don't believe the vast amount of science, even if they want to deny climate change exists, most people acknowledge it. So there's going to be changes no matter what.
So what can we better do to address these impacts within the state's borders that we aren't doing now?
I mean, I've tasked Department of Environmental Quality and Department of Administration and others to really take a look at energy conservation, not just on state buildings, but programs that can go out, you know, throughout the state, creating jobs at the same time that you're making places more energy efficient. Because the most significant immediate move would deal with consumption. Look, I recognize that folks who certainly saying we need to cut back on our fossil fuels because of carbon, but also the detractors of renewables say you don't have sort of the consistency and we don't have a grid. And I think the only certainty in all of this is that our future is going to look a lot different than what it is today. There's a lot more going on in Montana, sometimes behind the meter, but across the state when it comes to solving parts of what this energy future is going to look like. When you look at the wind production that's already gone in, others that are looking at it as we work on transmission issues, when you look at trying to handle some of the challenges, I mean, I've been up to a company in the Flathead that is getting closer and closer to developing a battery that will take care of some of the variability of wind so that they could store. In the Flathead area, I've been to a company that is working on sort of the bioalgae things to produce energy. Or you look at Stoltz Lumber up there as well, who is doing power generation through burning, you know, more or less some of their chips and things, the cogeneration. That's why I say in part we need to look a ways down the road, because there are some exciting things toward energy innovation and development that's occurring in our state.
So if you talk to climate scientists, they will say of all carbon emitters, coal is the absolute worst. It is the dirtiest form of energy we have. You talk about the impacts of climate change across the state. You talk about some of the things that we should do to try to mitigate those effects. But you are also in favor of developing Montana's coal reserves and sending those coal reserves overseas. Do you see a contradiction there?
I think that we need to recognize that you're not going to be flipping switches off overnight no matter what. I mean, you're looking at a 30 to 40 years, I think, before we would completely transition out of coal. Or also, though, this provides the opportunity to innovate and say, how can we more effectively use coal and reduce some of the greenhouse gases? Part of what our overall energy future is going to look like is depending on how all coal can be utilized in new and different ways. I mean, think about the technology in our smartphones, how much that's changed just in the last, 3 years even. We really haven't had that many technological changes when it comes to how we're utilizing burning coal.
But much of what is being proposed for Montana's coal reserves is to be selling it out of country to countries in Asia where there aren't the kinds of restrictions that you're talking about.
Yeah, well, first, I mean, to step back, what I'm talking about in the United States isn't even necessarily the restriction side of it. It's like, let's work on the technology side so we can either find uses for the carbon or reduce that. I don't think it's feasible in the United States or around the world to say tomorrow we're shutting off coal. Nor do I think it's probably in our state's or country's best interest. There will be transitions and changes in the economy, and hopefully it'll be in the upcoming truly decades.
If you do talk to climate scientists again, they will say that the time for dramatic change is now, that we are getting closer and closer to these benchmarks where we cannot reverse some of the changes that are happening. Should the U.S. not be leading by example in that?
Well, I think in some respects, when you look at some of the ways now energy's being developed in the United States, we are leading by example. But in point of fact, if you shut down and said there will be no more coal development in Montana, it might make some folks feel good, but it's not going to change the overall levels of what we're looking at. So we need to be looking to find solutions, but solutions isn't either, you know, well, we won't do any renewables or we won't do any coal, because that's not really going to get, I think, our economy or our energy mix anywhere.
You do support allowing the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline?
I do.
That also, from environmental groups, they will say tar sands oil is also very, very polluting.
Well, I think it's, at the end of the day, a number of things. I mean, and it'll not only create jobs, it not only provides the opportunities for energy independence, it's also a safe way to transport, done right. And as long as those are met, private property rights are protected, I think that it could be really good for the United States. Now, the oil production, I think, will continue either way. The Keystone, in part, has been, I think, for some also kind of a proxy for all of the frustration that we're not doing more on climate change.
Governor, last legislative session, you did oppose changes to Montana's renewable portfolio standard, which requires utilities to buy 15% of their electricity from renewable sources. Environmental groups do applaud you for that. There are some thoughts that a potential move in this next legislative session would be cutting Montana's net metering requirements. And those say, so if somebody has a solar panel on their roof and they generate more power than they use per month, utilities have to pay that homeowner for the power through lowering their power bill. Now, Northwestern Energy has not said whether or not they would be pursuing any bills to cut back on that net metering scheme, but they are part of a trade association that has aggressively opposed and attacked net metering in other states. If that sort of a measure does work its way into the legislature next time, ends up on your desk, how would you approach something like that?
Well, I've even in through the legislative process last time, I said I want to see what actually gets on my desk before saying I'd sign or veto something. But at the end of the day, there is some exciting things going on more or less behind the meter, and net metering is one of those. There's some small-scale wind projects, one of which that I've toured kind of near Roundup. So those sort of things where we can sort of change the overall dynamics of energy consumption, and also when we can even feed energy back in, I think that's exciting innovation. And it's at times innovation household by household or a much smaller scale than a significant hydro facility. But it's areas where we need to be, I think, advancing and pursuing.
Many policymakers and scientists are looking from whether or not climate change is happening and how do we prevent that toward looking into how do we adjust for the changes that are already happening. Are there changes that Montana needs to make?
I mean, in part, those two go together. And we've had discussions around the cabinet about what are the impacts going to be just to state government from an adaptation as things change. And certainly that could have costs when you look at from fire seasons to different flooding to any number of areas. So we're actually, you know, working with the cabinet and having those discussions, because it's not sufficient for me as I look for my kids' future more than my own, even just to say, all right, it's such a huge problem, let's just focus on adaptation. Because I do think that we need to figure out and work toward continuing to reduce our carbon footprint. And I think that good things are happening in that area. The old coach Joe Glenn said, you know, you eat an elephant a bite at a time. So we need to look at those piece by piece by piece. Adaptation is certainly something that we need to look at, but we also need to be doing more.
Governor Steve Bullock, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight calls for partly cloudy skies with scattered rain and lows in the mid-30s to lower 40s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s. For central Montana tonight, there is a high wind warning in effect until 6 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front, Toole, and Liberty counties. Tonight should be partly cloudy with lows 40 to 45 degrees with wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies and a chance of rain through the day with highs in the 50s and west wind gusts up to 40 miles per hour. For southwest Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with lows 35 to 40 degrees. And tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain through the morning and a chance of rain and snow in the afternoon. Highs are in the 50s. And now for the editorial comments of Al Smith.
GM, OGM, what to do about you? You hid dangerous defects from the public and federal regulators. You determined 50 cents was too high a cost to you to fix the problem, and as a result, Americans have needlessly died. If it weren't for those pesky family members who lost a loved one seeking accountability from you and the trial lawyers that represent them, you wouldn't be the butt of late-night comedy sketches. Though you have somewhat of an explanation, it wasn't all your fault. I've spoken in the past about federal regulatory agencies being used in the Bush era to further corporate interests. I have explained how the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, and the Food and Drug Administration had all used rule changes to preempt citizen lawsuits against manufacturers of defective products by preempting state negligence standards and replacing them with corporate-approved agency standards. Manufacturers of harmful products have been very good in convincing federal agencies of their point of view. However, they've been less successful in convincing juries and state courts that they should not be held accountable for injuries and deaths that could have been prevented with reasonable and feasible safety modifications. The citizen lawsuits in state courts have been an incentive for industries to improve the safety of products. Often, industries agree to safety standards only after they've been held accountable by juries and state courts for injuries and deaths that could have been prevented with reasonable and feasible safety modifications. To Obama's credit, his administration has not followed that corporate strategy, and it has reversed many of their preemptions granted manufacturers under Bush. But one area where the Obama administration is the same as the Bush years, actually is the same as under every administration since the 1960s, is that of corporate influence over the regulatory process. Every administration operates under laws imposed by Congress, and with few exceptions, Congress has assured that federal regulators' hands are tied when it comes to effectively protecting citizens from harmful products. For a little background on GM's current predicament, we need to go back to 1965, the year Ralph Nader's book, Unsafe at Any Speed, was published. Nader argued that corporations ignored safety in favor of larger profits, and that the only way to hold auto manufacturers accountable to the public was federal regulation. Rather than rebutting Nader's charges about GM's unsafe products, or better yet, making its products safer, GM hired a private detective to shadow Nader and probe into his personal life to try to find something to kill the messenger. When the unsuccessful detecting by GM was revealed, Congress actually enacted the first auto safety laws. Now, Congress didn't want to get too carried away with protecting the public from dangerous autos. Since its creation in 1970, NHTSA has always operated under congressional laws and restrictions that has kept it from being too protective of the public. One of the ways Congress has protected corporations is true of NHTSA and all other federal agencies, by limiting the money provided to an agency to do its job. Agencies can't do their jobs effectively with inadequate funds for research and enforcement, and even if adequately funded, agencies are further hamstrung by limitations on their enforcement powers. Corporate automakers have been very successful at convincing NHTSA of their point of view. Tight purse strings have led to standards written by the auto industry and their agents in NHTSA. Never mind whether the standards do little to actually protect citizens from known safety hazards that account for thousands of deaths each year. Never mind whether the industry has known about a clear link between design defects and severe injury for decades. Never mind that corporations can keep dangerous defects secret from NHTSA. Never mind that NHTSA can't force corporations to recall dangerous vehicles until well after lives are needlessly lost. Congress has assured that corporations get standards that fall well short of truly protecting consumers. And it could be possible that the revolving door of working at NHTSA, then working for the corporate automakers, then working for NHTSA again, and so on, also has something to do with that. GM's latest problems have followed a familiar pattern. GM knew of the defect and kept it secret. They made a financial decision to not correct the defect. They got sued by the families of victims killed by the defect. They settled cases in secret to further hide the problem. And finally, a family's lawyer found the smoking gun documentation of the problem and the cover-up. Corporate America too often acts like a spoiled child. Their reaction to questioning of why they don't reveal safety problems sooner is too often like a poorly parented child's. I only hid that from you because if I told you what I'd done, you would have punished me. As any good parent knows, telling the truth is a positive, but it does not mean that punishment through accountability and responsibility is ignored. So what can be done? Let's give regulators the money and tools they need to truly protect the public, and let's prevent secret settlements that hide dangerous risks from the public. This is Al Smith for the Montana Trial Lawyers.
Al Smith is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.